From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief Radio airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. I can't brag on our listeners enough. If you stepped up on Giving Tuesday, as many did, or at any time during this past week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, I urge you to make a tax-deductible contribution today. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, that information is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, December 3rd starts the Christian pre-Christmas season of Advent. Wednesday is St. Nicholas Day. And on Friday, Buddhist mark Bodhi Day. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, President P.T. Barnum tweeted out a tragic three-ring circus of ugly anti-Muslim propaganda videos this week. It's likely he got confused by the name of the hate group responsible for the videos. After all, the fascist Britain First sounds an awful lot like his own America First slogan. We'll have to assume, yet again, that nobody told him that this language was deployed during World War II for tragic anti-Semitic purposes. But back to those videos. The Prime Minister of our closest ally, the UK, condemned the promotions of these dishonest and destructive messages. The petty and childish response from the nominal leader of the free world was almost impossible to digest. Except for his focused followers, for whom the thin skin of the president is more precious than our most treasured international relationships. Holland also had to object publicly to lies that one video promoted about an assault on a young Dutch man. But the commander-in-chief's troll army was unperturbed that the disabled victim of that attack desperately wanted to avoid further humiliation and publicity, because only one man's feelings seem to matter anymore. All of this, while North Korea is deploying an unprecedented level of long-range missile launching skills. Two voices have been echoing painfully in my head all week in connection to all of this. The first is of failed presidential candidate, former Arkansas governor and ordained pastor Mike Huckabee's daughter, Sarah.
Regardless of the video, the threat is very real.
The other was former Republican senator and now morning television host Joe Scarborough, who could not contain his frustration, anger, and naked fear in the face of this week's event.
When is this the right time to talk about a mentally unstable president in the White House and a nuclear showdown with another unstable madman in North Korea? Is it after the first nuclear missiles fly?
We've been living an outrageous television reality show masquerading as a representative democracy for months and months now. A number of us have tuned out. Change the channel, as it were. But the real reality is there is no other channel. There is no other superpower. Retreating into fantasy or denial will only work until the lights go out. And make no mistake, as the American citizens of Puerto Rico recently found out, the lights do and will go out. The internet, too. And the water. None of these things happened by themselves. They require consistent, responsible, proactive active maintenance and care. They require money. They require accountability. They require systems and measures and facts and figures. And heaven help us if we haven't figured out a way to cancel this tragic TV series before that day comes. President Bannon is unafraid of the consequences of his beloved chaos. But you and I and the rest of us should be, Republican and Democrat, Southerner and Yankee, young and old, Christian, Muslim, Jew, atheist, you and I. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
They're liberals. They don't want conservative values. They're the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender who want to change our culture. They're socialists who want to change our way of life, putting man above God.
As is too often the case with mainstream media, a story can receive wall-to-wall coverage and then suddenly all but disappear. With the special Senate election in Alabama still almost 2 weeks away, it's set for December 12th, I don't feel bad that we at least are not looking away. If ever there was a cautionary tale for what can happen when politics trumps religion, we're seeing it in Alabama right now. And for an on-the-ground look, I'll talk with Rabbi Barry Leff, who leads Temple Beth El in Birmingham.
I don't plan on giving up my religious beliefs. This is who I am. It's what I believe. And as a follower of Jesus Christ, I don't believe that that's what he wants me to do. And so I would, my priorities would be towards my faith.
As we regularly insist on this show, far too many claims of deeply held religious beliefs have come to be code for deeply held discriminatory convictions. And fanning that fire is the deep pocket legal nonprofit Alliance Defending Freedom. This is ugly and troubling and bad enough, but new reporting by the invaluable Sarah Posner reveals that the tentacles of this corrosive campaign are getting institutionalized in the very courts that we look to for some relief. On this week's show, Sarah will be here with us to give us disturbing details. But first,
the Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation said the plan would not pay for itself and end up adding $1 trillion in deficits, with a T.
Sister Simone Campbell, Executive Director of Network, has spoken out forcefully and articulately about the moral aspects of this legislation, and I am so grateful to have her back with us on State of Belief Radio. Simone, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, as always, it's an honor to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
So the Senate passed this tax bill on a partisan vote despite clear data showing the economic harm it will cause the American people. I can't even ask for all of your thoughts, but tell me some of your thoughts about that.
Well, the top of my mind is we still have a lot more work to do, and we can still stop this very bad bill for our nation. It appears, and I say appears because, as you're saying, it's chaos time, but it appears that there's going to be a conference committee to solve the differences between the House and the Senate version. And that will mean that it will come back to both houses for another vote. And they've got to find a compromise that all of the Republicans can accept. And at this point, there are some serious divisions. But the bottom line is, I'm horrified by this vote. But I am, and Network, our organization, is totally committed to stopping it at this next step.
Mm. Why do we talk about this in moral terms?
Well, because this is a moral issue. What do we commit to pay for as a nation? And that's what taxes are. Taxes aren't just some you know, punishment where you have to pay a fine. That's in the criminal system. But the fact is, taxes are what we choose to invest in as a nation. What do we care about as we the people, and who are and what are we going to invest in? Now, what has gotten totally lost in this tax conversation is that the choices of how much money we collect then becomes a choice about how much money are we willing to spend. Now, the Republicans are saying, who have always been deficit hawks, who have been saying no more deficit, we can't have a deficit, we have to cut spending, they are committing to spending over $1 trillion in debt to give corporations a bigger tax break. Now, the thing that's horrifying to me, that's a moral issue, is by choosing to do that, you are choosing to not invest in our people. Mm-hmm. And it's that choice to not invest in our people, to penalize our people. Mm-hmm. I mean, the House bill has that students, folks who have graduated with student debt would not be able to deduct the interest that they're paying on their student debt. I mean, they've got additional cuts to the child tax credit for some families. Our families are going to suffer. That is a moral choice that we're making for the sake of large corporations.
They're not even looking at moral values as a goal. They're looking at campaign money made available to them because they passed this legislation.
Exactly. And so it's self-interest that's driving this. I mean, they have held out this thing that they should slash taxes. That's their plan. But in so doing, they're going to hurt our people. Mm-hmm. And that is wrong in my book. They have this theory called trickle-down economics, which means that you give more money to people at the top, and then they're going to raise wages. They'll pay more wages, and they'll create more jobs. Mm-hmm. But we've been doing this same policy for 35 years, and we know how jobs are, and we know how wages are. Wages are low and flat.
Yeah.
So what I say is, you know what the definition of insanity is? Where you keep doing the same thing over and over, but you expect a different result.
Yeah.
So this bill really is immoral, but it's also insane. It's based on total faulty premises.
When you look at this legislation through the eyes of your faith, through the eyes of Network Lobby and your activist partners, what are the areas of greatest concern for you?
Well, I think looking at it from the eyes of faith, especially as we in the Christian tradition approach Christmas, it's what do we do to the least of these? I mean, What the huge cuts would result in: housing cuts, Medicare cuts, Medicaid cuts. It's going to result in food stamp cuts. I mean, and one of the pieces that's missed is that some of these cuts will be automatic just because they've driven up the debt so much. And so there is absolutely no care about the impact of having people with food insecurity not be able to access food. Mm-hmm. That's moral.
Yeah.
In my book, who are we as the richest nation on earth that we cannot care for the least? Just this morning, our organization's been doing a day of service just to keep our feet on the ground and connected with folks. And I was at a homeless drop-in shelter talking with guys about who are struggling so hard. And some of the guys that I was talking with at the homeless shelter are employed, but they don't have enough salary to be able to pay for housing in the D.C. area. I mean, and now the Senate is proposing that they're going to cut all these services? That's a moral issue in my book. It's wrong.
Well, it's shocking how the normal lawmaking process seems to have been abandoned in favor of just purely partisan pandering. Are there consequences here short of just voting out of office everybody that we can?
Well, I mean, quite frankly, some days that's what I think is the only answer in this. But do you know what I worry about, Weldon?
Democrats.
Okay, so we vote out the Republicans and we vote in the Democrats who've been so hurt, so put out, so marginalized in this process. The temptation is to return and do the same thing, only Democrats doing it to Republicans. Yeah. And what we, the people, have got to stand up and say, no, we will elect people who will work together. Because there are different views. It is possible to have a different view. But when you're not listening to anybody, that's not faithful. And it's not the way forward. So I think one is elections are going to be critical. And you should know that in both the House and the Senate bill, it appears that there are provisions that churches and nonprofits would be able to endorse candidates going forward. There's some serious problems with that, but appears to be in both bills.
Yeah.
But what we have to do is say we have a higher bar. We, as people of faith, are going to require that we have dialogue, engagement, and listening to varieties of perspective and finding a shared common good way forward. But we've got to preference the needs of the most vulnerable. That's faith. That's where we are.
Simone, I'm not getting a sense that the entrenched forces on the political religious right, the Americans who are thrilled to be in power, are particularly alarmed with the ongoing deterioration of both civility at home and of our stature in the world. So much of our public rhetoric is being built on untruths. I know each of our respective religious traditions describes a, quote, father of lies. So how do we reconcile dishonesty as a tactic with the critical need for integrity and fundamental decency?
Well, I think that's where the seduction of power, and in the Christian tradition, it makes me think of the early story of Jesus being out in the desert and being tempted by the temptress for power. And the fact is, it appears that some leadership who have been seduced by access to power have lost sight of the need for the fact that the truth will set us free. That lies only bind us in division and hate, and that we have, as people of faith, have to stop it. That the power is so seductive that truth gets lost. And so at this point, my perspective is we need prayer, we need engagement, we need clarity, and most of all, we need a conversion of heart in our nation to move away from this very divisive, destructive approach. But, you know, Weldon, I have to say, I mean, I know the seduction of power. I mean, it is pretty alluring to have, you know, members of Congress, the Senate, all this, you know, recognize me, be excited to see me, that kind of thing. So there is a seduction. This is not like it's easy. But the fact is that only prayer and continued reflection can keep our focus on what really matters.
Yeah, that's a great observation, and it highlights the importance of people in Congress as well as people elsewhere, too, to discipline themselves by democracy and by morality. That would help immensely.
Amen.
Sister Simone Campbell is Executive Director of Network Lobby for Catholic Social Justice and the original nun on the bus. Her invaluable book on grassroots organizing and spirit-filled activism is titled A Nun on the Bus, How All of Us Can Create Hope, Change, and Community. And I dare say it would make a wonderful gift during the holidays. Simone, as always, thank you for doing this.
Oh, it's an honor. Thank you, Weldon. Glad we all can do our parts together.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. I'll ask Rabbi Barry Leff of Birmingham how the Moore Senate campaign is forcing Alabama faith communities into partisan corners. And up next, journalist Sarah Posner on the infiltration of our justice system by political religious right. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. When the history of our age is written, I believe one of the most glaring oversights that will be identified is the way progressives dismiss the power and persistence of the political religious right. And it's not hard to see why. For most of us, every step toward inclusion and dignity for every person seems almost inevitable, a slow but inexorable evolution. But not everyone sees it that way. The state our nation and much of the world finds itself in today can be directly traced back to the divisive tactic of turning people against each other, using culture war tactics and religious rhetoric. It helped elect the leaders we're cursed with today. And often, the last recourse is the U.S. court system. Terrifying, that is also far from a sure thing going forward. And joining me to explain why is investigative journalist Sarah Posner, who writes about this latest theocratic assault on our civil society in The Nation magazine. It's a great piece. Her article is headlined, "The Christian Legal Army Behind Masterpiece Cake Shop, A Special Investigation into the Rise of Alliance Defending Freedom." And I am so pleased it brings the author back to State of Belief Radio. Sarah, thanks so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me, Welton.
The Supreme Court will be hearing the Colorado Cake Baker case as Masterpiece Cake Shop Limited versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission has come to be known later this month. For many on the political right, it's one in a long line of legal cases in response to a wholesale trampling of religious rights in this country. But in fact, it's one in a long list of legal cases expertly crafted to redefine religious liberty in a way our founding fathers would never dream of. Sarah, would you agree with that?
Yes. I think that in terms of the free exercise clause, which is one of the claims that Masterpiece Cake Shop is making in this case, I do not think that it was anticipated either by the founding fathers or by the architects of the civil rights laws in the 1960s or by the court itself in interpreting those civil rights laws that there would be a gaping exemption for people who claim to have a religious objection to serving certain kinds of people or certain kinds of activities that those certain kinds of people engage in, i.e. a same-sex wedding.
Yeah. Well, listeners absolutely need to read your full report to get the important details. But in short, this Masterpiece Cake Shop case is sort of a masterpiece for the political religious right. And please talk about that so our listeners understand what's going on here.
Well, the case was brought by Alliance Defending Freedom. They are a religious right legal group. So they were founded to be basically like a Christian answer to the ACLU. But a lot of the drive to found this organization back in the early to mid-1990s was what its founders saw as the advance, correctly saw, as the advance of LGBTQ rights in the United States. And they saw that as far back as 1992, 1993, as an assault on their Christian values and as potentially something that, in their mind, would silence the church and silence Christians and silence Christianity. So they've been building this organization over the years, training lawyers who work in alliance with them around the country, lawyers who are in private practice, training law students in their particular legal ideology, and growing their fundraising so that, you know, today they draw in $40, $50 million a year in contributions. And so they have this big war chest and a big army, in their terms, of a legal army of lawyers who are helping them advance different kinds of cases that are aimed at chipping away and potentially even overturning the rights that have been gained by LGBTQ people over the past couple of decades.
Hmm. Sarah, just how big is the legal firm representing the anti-gay Baker, the Alliance Defending Freedom group?
Well, ADF has 58 staff attorneys. They claim to have trained 3,000 allied attorneys, people who are in private practice who act as co-counsel with them in cases. And they claim to have trained 1,800 law students through their Blackstone Legal Fellows program. The Blackstone Legal Fellows then go on to work in private practice, work in the government, work in attorney general's offices around the United States. In fact, several former ADF staff attorneys now have high positions in attorney general offices in various states around the country. We found 18 ADF-affiliated attorney general staff in 10 states around the country. So they have not only a big staff and a big war chest, but they have enormous reach. Even some of Trump's judicial nominees, one of whom has already been confirmed, have ties to ADF. Amy Coney Barrett, who was just confirmed to the Seventh Circuit and who Trump has identified as being on his shortlist for the Supreme Court, spoke to this Blackstone Legal Fellows program in the past. And this is a program that trains young law students in the Christian legal principles that ADF espouses. Christian in air quotes, I suppose.
My guest is investigative journalist Sarah Posner, who's got an explosive new report in The Nation magazine. It's headlined, "The Christian Legal Army Behind Masterpiece Cake Shop." Sarah, as if it weren't worrisome enough to have this giant legal firm working to undermine our secular justice system with its lawyers, you cover the terrifying prospect of this agenda getting inside the system. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, what we're seeing now, in addition to the judicial nominees, and in addition to judicial nominees who don't have a direct tie to ADF but share the same sort of view of the legal system, the more judicial nominees that Trump gets confirmed, the more chances ADF has to win these sorts of cases. Everybody's watching Masterpiece Cake Shop so closely, no one suspects that Gorsuch will vote any differently than Scalia would have, but certainly Merrick Garland would have likely voted differently than the late Justice Scalia. So it's being watched closely because we're looking at what's Justice Kennedy going to do. What would happen down the road should Justice Kennedy or one of the other liberal justices retire and Trump get the opportunity to replace them with somebody like Amy Coney Barrett. So people who watch what the Supreme Court does, we're watching all of this very closely. If the Supreme Court were to rule in favor of ADF, that's basically like saying the civil rights laws in this country can be whittled away by the supposed religious objections of people, something the Supreme Court has rejected in the past with regard to civil rights laws that protect people from discrimination on the basis of race. Yet, with the Trump administration, the Justice Department is on ADF's side. They have filed a brief in the case. The Solicitor General is going to get argument time in the case alongside ADF's lawyer. So this is a mission that is being embraced not just by the religious right, but by the Trump administration as well.
So are we on the way to having the very way religious freedom and freedom of expression are interpreted by our courts changed forever?
I think that's overstating it just because we do not know how the Supreme Court is going to rule. And I'll just point out that this is a little bit in the legal weeds, but the free exercise claim that ADF has raised in this case, that Masterpiece Cake Shop has raised in this case, is not particularly strong because of that race case that I discussed moments ago. In the 1960s, the Supreme Court found that the argument that a racist barbecue stand owner made, that serving black customers violated his religious beliefs, was a patently frivolous argument. So the free exercise claim is a little bit difficult for them to make, and they don't have a RFRA claim because the statute at issue here is a Colorado state statute, not the federal civil rights statute that protects people from discrimination in public accommodations. So they could not raise RFRA, the same statute that they used in the Hobby Lobby case here. So they're stuck with the free exercise claim, which they clearly think is their less strong claim because they make it second. They've really made much of their free speech claim, arguing that Jack Phillips, the owner of Masterpiece Cake Shop, is not a baker. He is not a mere baker. He is a cake artist. There's an artistry and an artistic expression involved here, and they're making the argument that by forcing him, in their mind, to make the cake for the same-sex wedding, that's an infringement, a government infringement on his artistic expression and therefore compelled speech, which is prohibited by the First Amendment, by the free speech clause of the First Amendment. So they're making some really novel legal claims here. Mm-hmm. If accepted by the Supreme Court, it would be rather earth-shattering, I think, but it's not a slam dunk that they're going to win it, although it would be extremely troubling if they did.
Yeah. Where else do you see the ADF having a direct impact inside our government?
Well, there are a number of people with ties to ADF who are in the Trump administration, most notably Matthew Bowman, who was one of their top attorneys on abortion and contraception and religious exemptions relating to abortion and contraception. When I talk about those kinds of religious exemptions, like the sort of exemptions that were obtained in Hobby Lobby, where employers do not have to provide the copay-free contraception coverage to their employees, or pharmacists who object to filling prescriptions for emergency contraception and that sort of thing. Bowman is now Deputy General Counsel at the Department of Health and Human Services. That is the agency that deals with potential religious objections to provision of health care and health care services. So that, in my mind, is quite significant. Also, Attorney General Sessions has been very friendly with ADF. They not only intervened in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, but they also intervened in another ADF case, which is at the district court level now, where ADF is claiming that a university infringed on the free speech and free exercise rights of a student by asking him not to preach just in an area of the campus where it might be a disturbance to other students, when the campus has free speech zones where students can apply for a permit to speak and speak their minds at certain times and place. And the Justice Department saw that it was important to them to intervene in that case on ADF's behalf. We know that ADF helped advise DOJ in adopting the religious freedom guidelines that President Trump ordered the Justice Department to implement via executive order. And significantly in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, Solicitor General Noel Francisco, who filed the brief supporting ADF's position and asked for argument time from the Supreme Court, was identified on ADF's website as one of their allied attorneys, one of these 3,000 attorneys across the country who go through a training and sign a statement of faith and help ADF with cases. Now, after we went to press with that, based on the press releases that ADF has had on its website identifying him as an allied attorney, ADF objected strenuously to that reporting and said that he was not an allied attorney with ADF, and they subsequently altered their website to change that identification on those press releases. Those press releases are from 2016, so they had been on ADF's website for quite some time. This is significant because if there's anything that would make the Solicitor General appear not to be impartial in a case that DOJ was getting involved in here, that he would have to undergo an ethics review and have an ethics person in DOJ determine whether he might be seen as not impartial in the case. So that's quite significant whether he is or is not an ADF allied attorney when jumping into this case representing the United States government in supporting ADF here. But ADF went ahead and changed that. They claimed that he was never, despite what was on their website, that he was never an allied attorney with ADF and changed those press releases.
Let me go back to Masterpiece Cake Shop for a moment. You write in alarming terms of the permanent damage the Supreme Court could do to our fundamental understanding of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Let's add to that, for many decades, the United States has been a model of freedom, admired and emulated by nations around the world. How big an impact could this really have in the broadest terms?
Let me just say that the entire body of cases in this area, in the area of the collision between LGBTQ rights and what ADF claims is religious freedom, the entire body of that is aimed at chipping away at every single LGBTQ right that has been gained over the past couple of decades, including the right to marriage equality. Mm-hmm. So I think that their aim eventually would be to overturn Obergefell versus Hodges, the case that made marriage equality the law of the land. In the meantime, they sort of like think about it like the religious rights abortion strategy. They would very much like to overturn Roe versus Wade. But in the meantime, let's chip away at that right and figure out how we can make it less accessible to people, less robust. So in the area of LGBTQ rights, I think that they're looking to chip away at Obergefell. So, you can get married, right? But in Colorado, that has a public accommodation statute that protects people from discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. You can't go and just get a cake for your wedding from, you know, any baker that whose cakes you like. So they're chipping away at, like, freedom and equality in that way. But they're also redefining it. Redefining freedom as, well, freedom is really about freedom for us, for Christians. It's the Christians whose rights have been chipped away at, in their view, and that the gains in LGBTQ rights necessarily mean chipping away at rights for Christians, and so those need to be regained for Christians. And so that would change the way the courts, if they were successful, it would change the way the courts look at religious freedom and free exercise and separation of church and state claims, because they would be looking at it from the standpoint of Christians' rights are under threat, as opposed to everyone in this country has the right to religious expression, and the government does not, the government is not infringing on the religious expression of any group by protecting the civil rights of people on the basis of race, mm-hmm. sex, gender, gender identity, sexual orientation, ethnicity, nationality, etc.
Sarah Posner is an investigative journalist doing invaluable work at the intersection of religion and politics, a reporter with the Nation Institute Investigative Fund. Sarah is the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Her investigative report, The Christian Legal Army Behind Masterpiece Cake Shop, appears in The Nation magazine, and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Sarah, thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me, Walton.
As we look on in horror at the spectacle of purportedly religious leaders endorsing Roy Moore in Alabama, some with song no less, it's essential for us to consider what this is doing to the religious communities that populate the state. Rabbi Barry Leff leads Temple Beth El in Birmingham, and he joins me now to examine the situation. Rabbi, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
From the outside, it seems that the entire faith community is actively gathering around Roy Moore. That's not entirely the case, is it?
No, it's not at all. You know, I guess the faith community that supports Roy Moore gets a lot of publicity because it's the old man bites dog kind of thing, right?
Uh-huh.
How can you have faith communities supporting someone who clearly seems to be lacking so much in character and has so many moral issues?
Mm-hmm.
So we do have faith communities. There have been petitions with pastors and so on who have signed strongly opposed to Roy Moore, but that hasn't gotten as much publicity.
Sure. How is this affecting relationships among faith leaders and members of congregations that have taken a position on Roy Moore?
You know, Alabama is a very polarized state. I mean, for example, if you drive around Birmingham, you see at least 20 yard signs supporting Doug Jones for every one supporting Roy Moore. But if you get outside of the major urban areas like Birmingham, it's you see all Roy Moore yard signs and nothing for Doug Jones. And so to a certain extent, I think we tend to isolate ourselves into communities of people who we agree with.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of, you know, the faith communities and interfaith work, the different communities that I interact with, we all share the same perspective of being horrified by the idea of electing Roy Moore. And I'm sure the people in the more rural areas who are the Roy Moore supporters don't engage in a lot of interfaith dialogue with people who have different perspectives than theirs. So I think it just reflects the polarization that we have
mm-hmm.
here.
Mm-hmm. I know some of the loudest voices endorsing Moore are actually from out of state. So is this noisier on the national stage than it really is in Alabama itself?
It's pretty noisy in Alabama, too. But there's no question that there have been people from out of state making noise as well. In fact, the only rabbi I know of who has supported Roy Moore is from out of state. He's not a local. I don't know any local rabbis who have expressed any support for Roy Moore.
Hmm. Rabbi Leff, would you talk about your own personal experiences with this controversy? How are you managing to lead a congregation that inevitably includes differing opinions?
Well, it's kind of interesting. With the elections last year, it was far more challenging because there were plenty of people in my congregation, you know, that supported both of the major candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And I think the work a rabbi needs to do around political issues, I think, is where we should be bringing the wisdom of Torah, the wisdom of the accumulated 3,000 years of Jewish grappling with moral and ethical issues, and we should be applying those lenses to contemporary issues.
Mm-hmm.
But we can apply those to contemporary issues without necessarily telling people how they should vote.
Right.
We can say, here are things the Jewish tradition says about this issue, not necessarily saying vote for X or vote for Y. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, with Roy Moore, there's much more unity in the Jewish community. And so last year, when I spoke about issues, it was controversial and some people got upset with me. Some people thought the things I was saying indicated thinly veiled support for one candidate over another candidate. Whereas around Roy Moore, the Jewish community at least seems to be much more united that he would be a terrible thing. I know I have many congregants who are Republicans who are supporting Doug Jones because they believe that the character of the person that's representing us and the Senate is important.
When you move from Torah and the principles and moral information that we get from those scriptures, what are the major values that you stress in a situation like this?
You know, we have a lot of values that I think are universal in different faith traditions. The respecting the other, the consideration that everyone is created in the divine image, so therefore everyone is entitled to a certain level of respect and recognition of that divine image. The need to take care of the poor, the need to take care of the people who are struggling, those are universal values. The need to take care of the environment is also part of Jewish teachings. And so those are the values that we can talk about. So, for example, we can talk about Jewish teachings on, you know, man was put on this world to guard it, not to destroy it. with at the same time not necessarily saying, for example, looking at a particular political issue, say the Paris Climate Accord, without necessarily saying whether we should support it or not support it, because there are many factors that have nothing to do with our values that might go into whether or not we should support that or not support that.
Yeah. What do our listeners need to know about Alabama right now that they probably don't know?
Alabama is not monolithic. I think there's a lot of people that just read about the different scandals that we have here and just think the whole state is messed up. Mm-hmm. And that's not true. You know, there are many, many people here who are good people, who care about things like character, who have integrity, who share many of the values that people on the coast or in other parts of the country have. The state is not just a solid, homogeneous place. Mm-hmm. There are many different opinions here as well. And in fact, the fact that the Senate race between Doug Jones and Roy Moore is fairly close tells you something about that. Yeah. It's not a slam dunk that Roy Moore will win.
Yeah. I'm always interested in what happens the day after an election as well as on election day. Do you think there will be lasting divisions regardless of how the campaign ends, or will faith leaders find ways to bridge the divide and move forward together, putting ministry above politics?
I think there'll be some lasting divisions, and in some ways I think the lasting divisions will be worse if Roy Moore wins, just because so many people are appalled by him and appalled by what Alabama would look like to the rest of the world if he's elected. Hmm.
Rabbi Barry Leff leads Temple Beth El in Birmingham, Alabama. He's also served as chairman of Rabbis for Human Rights. Rabbi, it really is helpful for us, and I appreciate so much you taking time today to give us an insight to what's going on the ground there. It's very helpful. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Now, before we go, I grew up believing the United States of America is the greatest nation on earth. But what makes a nation good? Many of my mentors credited the goodness of our nation to its generosity. It's not the eloquence of our speeches, our numerous ideologies, or the grand generalizations about our dreams. Listen, please, to the words of Mahatma Gandhi. A nation's greatness is measured by how it treats its weakest members. In applying this phrase today, I don't think we should limit it to a nationalistic, isolationist way. At least, we didn't used to do that. I felt great pride when I studied the Marshall Plan that followed World War II. The United States gave what would now be about $135 billion to help fund the recovery and restoration of the European countries that we had bombed to shreds earlier. More recently, when the tsunami smashed into Sri Lanka, leaving a trail of death and destruction, USA immediately responded with help and, over time, contributions of $350 million. After the earthquake in Haiti, we saw former Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush work together to get aid to the people on that island. You know the stories of our care for the world. They are numerous in number. But what's happening now? What kind of assistance is coming from the White House today? There is a disturbing answer to that question. Right now, we face the reality of American citizens in Puerto Rico living as third world citizens or worse, and receiving from the leadership of our nation hostility and lectures rather than water, food, electricity, and other forms of assistance. What has happened? responding to that question requires moving far beyond politics and daring to take an inventory of our moral principles and actions. Now, without question, we know that the president of our nation is devoid of sympathy and primarily interested only in helping people who have a lot of money and a will to vote for him in the next presidential election. I remember well some words from the last speech that U.S. Senator Hubert H. Humphrey delivered. Listen. The moral test of government is how that government treats those who are in the dawn of life, the children. Those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly. Those who are in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped. A few days ago, the Miami Herald carried Jacqueline Charles's story on contributions of over $2 billion to help rebuild the Caribbean islands decimated by the hurricanes that blew through that region just a few weeks ago. The charitable money was pooled during a one-day meeting of the United Nations and an organization called the Caribbean Community. The Netherlands pledged $700 million. The European Union pledged $315 million. Mexico itself, recovering from a disaster, pledged $27 million, and the politically shredded Venezuela forgave $1 million of debt. Canada chipped in $78 million, and China $30 million. During this meeting, the United States, once known around the world for its compassion and certainly not dealing with the magnitudes of economic challenges faced by Mexico or Venezuela, the United States contributed $4.3 million. Listen, Haiti, the poverty-plagued island still trying to recover from the 2010 earthquake and damage from other hurricanes, Haiti offered up to $250,000 to help the Caribbean islands. Reginald Dumas, a former U.S. advisor and longtime observer of regional politics, said, what all others must have been thinking, the money given by the United States is really ridiculous. But friends, it's not just Donald Trump. I read Paul Ryan's book and listened to his speeches, both filled with deep religious convictions and commitment to taking care of poverty in our nation. Now, that man, Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, is working to destroy Medicaid and Medicare. The tax plan his party unilaterally passed in the House of Representatives will take away health care from millions of people. The tax plan of the Republicans puts $1 billion in our president's pocket and hits the hardest, the poorest people in our nation. Where is morality? This plan is devoid of any relationship to moral values. Taxes go up for every family or person making less than $50,000. Tax rates improve substantially only for people making $250,000 or more. The tax plan cuts support for public schools and eliminates an embarrassingly little bit of money for underpaid teachers to buy supplies. The plan that is supposed to help us will cut support for families trying to put together enough money to pay their medical bills and will tax graduate students with tuition waivers that allow young people to go to school who otherwise could not go to school. America, we have a problem. Yes, we have a political problem. But a far greater problem exists in the moral principles, or should I say the lack of moral principles, so glaringly evident in the current leadership of our nation. This crisis is without question, and its reality should be scaring us to death. At stake is the character of our nation. The great student of democracy, Alexis de Tocqueville, told us a long time ago that America was great because America was good, but if America ever ceased to be good, America would cease to be great. I cannot get out of my mind and my deeply disturbed heart the truth voiced by Gandhi and many others. A nation's greatness is measured by how it treats its weakest members. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. In the gridlock our public rhetoric has become, it's more important than ever to amplify voices of reason and civil discussions the way we do every week on State of Belief Radio. Please support us and subscribe to the free weekly State of Belief podcasts on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in this ongoing discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.